You're listening to The Founders News,
your source for inspiration and insights into the vast world of entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Nathaniel Johnson, and we interview founders, CEOs, and world changers to get a better grasp of what it truly means to be a founder. Taking preconceived ideas into mind-boggling realities. But there's so much more than a podcast, it's a community. We empower startups with law, accounting, consulting, and more. So tune into the end of this episode to get involved with our partners, resources, and YFS as a whole.
Today we speak with Gary Hoberman, CEO of Uncork. Uncork is a New York-based company involved in cloud computing and enterprise software. They offer no-code development platforms for industries in financial services, insurance, the public sector, healthcare, and more. With various high-profile customers under their belt, Uncork ranked number 5 on Fast Company's Most Innovative Enterprise Tech Companies of 2022, and also ranked among Forbes America's Best Startups. In this episode, we discuss with Gary his journey to founding Uncork, from his initial professional endeavors to the ideas that eventually led him to found Uncork.
Let's do it. I'm ready when you are.
All right, perfect. So, yeah, we kind of touch upon, you know, obviously working with Uncork now. How do you pronounce that? Is it Uncork or?
It's Uncork, like the uncorking a bottle of wine. And that's what we named it. We named it after the concept that I've grown up in these large Fortune 50 Wall Street firms my entire life and, you know, get to climb that corporate ladder. But there's so much great things in these companies that I saw, but they were bottled up. They were all, you know, bureaucracy, everything stops. And so the concept was, could we unbottle or uncork what's great about these companies to kind of open them up to innovation? That's where the name came from.
I see. And that's exactly what you guys are doing, right? And enabling these companies to use these big APIs and applications with little to no code. Curious. I mean, you know, the kind of uncorking of something is a very unique and cool concept in the sense that there's, you know, so much, say, innovation or potential bottled up. And that's kind of a whole entrepreneur play. So kind of growing up and, you know, in the high school and college days, did you kind of take life with a similar aspect of being able to ultimately uncork the potential of different ideas and innovations? What was kind of your upbringing?
I was the kid in the back of the class with the skateboard. Like I was a sponsored skateboarder in high school. I was skateboarding in Brooklyn under the bridge. When Tony Hawk was just starting, I was in competitions and couldn't compete with him.
I'm from
New York. I'm a Queens kid. I grew up in Queens between Queens and Long Beach. So I've never lived outside of New York.
My sister lives in Flushing.
So I would say Flushing is where I was born and raised. And PS 164 and Parsons and Jim, you know, Forest Hills High School. So that was my junior high school. So just to tell you, like, that's, and so like to me, it's like, I would say I always had this spirit of like, if you believe in yourself, you could accomplish anything. And I learned that I was skateboarding, surfing, snowboarding, but it was like, the moment I learned that was I was probably like 14, and it was suddenly when you vision the trick and you're like, I could land a 360 off a ramp. Like there's no, and the second you convince yourself you could do it, you do it. Like that's the second you doubt yourself, you fail and learn and apply. So I've always been, my father was an entrepreneur. He had his own business, which was amazing to see him create and for 35 years run. And my sister is an entrepreneur. My brother's an entrepreneur. So I'm hoping my kids all follow in that footstep. They already are. So that's a good thing. They've each got their own ideas and businesses, but it's good.
That's great. I mean, yeah, in terms of skateboarding, I mean, kind of want to get to that a little before the whole entrepreneur game. I mean, that's impressive. I remember I used to skateboard back in the day, but definitely not doing anything tricks, just literally transportation. I mean, you're saying how it was all about believing that you could, you know, say, do a trick or perform something, and that led you to ultimately achieve it, right? If you doubted for 1 second, it couldn't happen. Do you think that, you know, that being what you're into, kind of a hobby back in the day, played into your entrepreneurial spirit now, and how has that kind of evolved into what you're working with?
You know, it's interesting. So, I truly believe, and I teach my kids this every day, is you learn most when you're uncomfortable. And be uncomfortable. I tell my team, I tell my kids, I tell everyone, like be as uncomfortable as you possibly can be. So, put yourself in those situations. So in college, like when I entered NYU Business, it was, I forced myself to take acting freshman year. And I was, as I mentioned, I was the kid in the back of the class that didn't want to be called on. And I was like, I just want to do my own thing. And acting was the most uncomfortable thing in my entire life. It was improv, you know, go in front of the class and you're king of the Eagles. And, you know, what does that do? And of course, cute girls in the class. And, you know, like you're definitely, there's, you know, humility is an aspect of that. And so, and I did it and I forced myself to do it. I didn't like it. I did not like it. I was uncomfortable. I was like, I remember going to each class and saying, I can't wait to be over, but I forced myself to do it. And like, to me, like that's life. Like life is pushing, you got to put yourself out there and force yourself to do something completely new and different. And, even when I created Uncork, like I was in a really good job, like, you know, like C-suite corporate executive. But I was miserable in what I saw was happening every day. And, you know, it took jumping out of that C-suite and like even the comfort of a corporate jet into what I say Zone 5 United, where no carry-on allowed. And you need to do that. Sometimes that's the leap. I think each of us needs to take that leap many times
in life. I mean, there's got to be a leap you have to take, especially if this, you're dying inside, right? So if you're, like you said, you're miserable, right? And so I guess it was a must.
You can see what's possible. I mean, to me, everywhere I look, there's something bigger and better that could be. I believe everyone's capable of doing more than they're doing today. That's my belief, is everyone's capable of contributing more, doing more, changing the world. And, you know, it'd be great to say we each left the world slightly better than when we entered it. And that's how I was kind of raised. That's the belief I have.
And yeah, I mean, that's amazing. I think that sort of mindset definitely would carry into, you know, whatever you do next and, you know, kind of jumping in early. Talk to me a bit about, you know, you said after college, you were, you know, a bit comfortable kind of in that C-suite and you took the jump, right, to make yourself uncomfortable. You know, talking about, you know, flying and all that. So of course, what was the kind of, you know, obviously the initial motive was to make yourself uncomfortable, but I guess what specifically, you know, whether it's the niche wise and kind of jumping out into that, you know, unknown, and especially a crucial, you know, moment of your life where that's the first time you're truly independent. There's not an infrastructure backing you as in high school and college. So,
And by the way, in college, I created a dry cleaner point of sale system at the point that there was no ticketing and automation. Like I sold it. It was a fun business to basically, you know, just, it wasn't big. It was just a small thing to see, but it taught me a lot. But when I entered, you know, out of college, I was like, I'm going to climb the C-suite. I thought it'd be fun to see how fast you could climb up the corporate ladder.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Top title was managing director. I'm like, how fast could I get there? Like, and what I learned was the skills that kind of separated me from everyone else was those skills that kind of got me excelled. And what I mean by that is like I did I was creative and I was doing video editing at a time when like there was no like digital, it was camcorders and editing. And I got good at it such that the CIO was like, hey, you know, I'm doing this town hall. Could you do something fun for the town hall and just show it in the video? And that's how he got to know me, was from that. It was not from my programming, but the reality was what I had seen in that journey was, I loved coding. I could speak 10 different languages to the machine at the same time. My mind was programmed to be able to speak to a machine and instruct it what to do and do it very well, I would say. And so what I had seen was when you're an engineer and you're given a task, it's like, go build this algorithm, go build this trading system, go build wealth management system. You do it and that's great. And then what happens is when you're a manager and you move up that corporate ladder, you have to now manage it. You have to see the costs and you have to see what you're building and you have to budget. And then when you're a department head or a division head or a company CIO, as I became the global CIO with 10,000 people working for me, what you start to realize is everything that you're creating, the thing you love most. So every single line of code, every single software we're creating is actually making the company worse. every package we're bringing in, every software package, every CRM package, every single thing we're doing is making the company worse for the shareholders, for the customers, for the employees. And it's a horrible feeling when you think about it, like the thing that you were trained to do, the thing that you do and you love doing is actually hurting the company you work for. And that was why I jumped out of the C-suite. And like, that was what was killing me, was like this idea that every single system we're deploying, we celebrate the deployment of a new software, a new app on an app store. And every single thing we were doing was just making the company harder to move forward instead of leapfrogging forward.
And I guess, did that sort of hindrance to the company kind of lead you to the ultimate inspiring of Uncork, and like how, I guess, that whole sort of system you're saying, bring in different packages? I know you guys work with AI and you're able to enable these huge companies now to kind of have like some sort of similar thing, right? These different platforms and they can use without having to code. So was that like a similar transition? Was there an intermediary period?
So let me change. So have you taken any basic computer science or hour of code or anything when you ever learn how to code? Like they still, I'm assuming they still force it.
Yeah. No,
but is that something you had to do?
Yeah, no, I'm a CSM job. I've actually like done some work with ML a little bit. And then I know C, Swift, Java. So definitely.
Yeah, if you know C, so think about this. C, Swift, Java. Love it. Like C, Swift, Java are three languages that humans have invented. We invented the entire language, right? The specification, public, class, final, main, whatever you want to call it, you know, and we've invented these languages to speak to a machine, and machines don't understand the language. And so humans then invented runtimes. If you think about a browser, you know, a browser needs to render HTML, a browser needs to render JavaScript as an engine. There's Gecko, there's like eight different JavaScript engines, depending on the browsers you use. And humans invented all this. And the combination of language and these runtimes result in an infinite complexity where it doesn't matter if AI is writing the code or helping you write the code, but the reality is when you deploy it, 80% of your spend is in keeping it running. So it wasn't, for me, it wasn't about writing C or Swift or Java. It wasn't about the creation. It was once it's created, how do you maintain it? How do you actually enhance it? How do you make it better? And the problem I saw was every app we were creating with C, Swift, or Java, whichever language you choose, you know, humans invented this cryptic language so only a few people could speak it.
I see, yeah.
And why? That was the question we asked. Why is that? Why do we accept that that's the truth? Why do we accept that you have to use Java or C or COBOL or assembler? Why? Who was right in their language preference to be able to do that, to restrict who could write it? So what we did was we looked at language, and it was really interesting. What we basically did was we looked at every aspect of language and DNA sequenced it into software. So we broke language and functions into data, into specifically data, and that whole software package becomes nothing but data. And the reason why I say data is machines understand data. So suddenly we could remove the nuance of a language and democratize it so anyone could speak to a machine, tell it what to do. And when they do it, they're doing it in a way which they don't need 10,000 hours behind them of Java or C. Yeah. They're doing it in a way where the support costs are 80% less than they're paying today, so that the company is left better off for the first time than worse off. And that's what Uncork's about. Uncork is democratizing technology, specifically in large enterprise regulated worlds where it's extremely complex, just to be able to actually make it friction proof and future proof in both ways.
And with all this, you know, talk about AI and where are we heading, I can imagine that this is a really critical, you know, moment for you guys. Maybe speak on that a little bit.
Yeah. So we, by the way, I wrote my first AI algorithm in 1994, so 30 years ago. Wow. I tried to predict off-track betting races, horse racing.
Oh, okay.
It didn't work. I'm here, right? So, like, if it worked, I would, you know. But it didn't work. But I tried. But it's magical, right? So when you could actually see something that simulates magic, that's what I think we've all experienced with generative AI these recent days, from images and DALL-E and ChatGPT and OpenAI. So we view the world very, very interesting. Like, we plug into everything. We have, you know, you could talk to ChatGPT and it will build an OnCork app without a single line of code. And, you know, it actually will function and work. And that's magical. But my view of AI is there's a lot of talk of AI to help create software, to write code, to write those C and Swift and Java languages we mentioned, and to help you write those. And that's what I would say is the biggest disaster to ever do. So if you think about it, we eliminated languages 6 years ago when we created OnCork. There's no language in software, but if you enable anyone to speak to ChatGPT to generate C or Swift or Java, the code they're generating is going to run in a runtime that they can't control, they can't choose. That runtime is going to have security issues, vulnerability issues, performance issues. It's going to have all these, they call the illities of enterprise software, which is like your reliability, your adaptability, usability, all the things you need to worry about. And then like, and it's going to then cost you 80% to maintain it. So there's no benefit. So to me, like, I'm super excited by, like, you know, generative AI and what it could do to help, you know, how we speak to call centers or operations or reduce expense. Or for me, it's, you know, could be helping write an email, and it could be like, it's amazing. It's magical. From an OnCork perspective, we work with every AI engine, Bedrock. We work with SageMaker. We work with Google, AutoML and Microsoft, OpenAI. So we've worked with them all. We continue to, and, we plug in the best, because it's not something we will build, because there's others who have created it better than us, and we'll just make sure we leverage it for you and your benefit.
Yeah. I mean, industry leader, to say the least. Just the list goes on. Of who you're working with. But I guess a big question would be, like, how do you protect yourself, you know, with this technology being so new? I mean, AI is certainly not what it was in 94 when you first were getting into the realm. And so how are you guys going to make sure, you know, 5 years from now or 5 days from today, you guys are protected and, you know, remains true to, you know, whatever your vision and goals are?
Yeah, it's a great question. Boy, that's, you both could be investors. You know, that would be what you're asking a question.
Funny you say that.
Yeah.
He is an investor.
Are you really? So tell me, what are you investing in? What's your thesis?
My buddy and I kind of made this venture studio right now. So we're kind of like putting out checks with student founders and giving them developers, et cetera. So
try to aspire. So look, I'll answer the question. Then I want to, you know, I'll talk to you about an incubator as well, which we've stood up, which is kind of cool. But the first question, like, on the, you know, to us, you always have to be the latest and greatest technology and know how to use it, because everyone's asking those questions. Generative AI to us is the idea that we bring it together. We're the technology that could orchestrate the calls and use the data within underwriting, or use it within opening an account, or use it within know your customer, all these things that are done in banks. Or healthcare, where we've launched a healthcare startup. It's a few weeks away from full launch, which is pretty cool to see. The entire startup was built in OnCork without a single engineer, without a single CTO. There's no one in the startup with tech. So, and it's a full healthcare startup, which is going to change health specialty care. So, with that said,
it's not just the big corporations then.
So we have several startups. Okay. We have one of the more exciting startups that's entirely on OnCork is called Aerodie, and it's a diversity and inclusion gamification, where could any size company give their employees the ability to gamify diversity and inclusion goals. So, hey, I'm going to help with marketing, help with this, and how do you actually track it and score it, and how does it? And we're a customer of that. The entire application was built in OnCork. We have, you know, one of the larger, you know, crypto companies, let's just say, is using OnCork as their base. We have, you know, we have a lot of life science companies using OnCork as the base. And then we have public sector, where federal government is using us, Washington, D.C. If anyone in your listeners got married in New York City, we did the marriage last year, the year before. So, like, it's interesting. So back to, like, so to me, it's about, like, always saying our goals are to bring the best technology together for the solution. What's the problem you're solving? And AI could be that. It doesn't have to be. the biggest problem right now is AI needs data, and data doesn't exist in most companies. So we help with the data. We help getting that clean. We help creating it. And then so you then could use it. There's no magic bullet, by the way. Anyone thinking they're going to just deploy AI and basically solve a problem is that's wrong. That doesn't work. And back to the incubator concept. So I'd love to hear more about your incubator. We built an incubator where we funded several companies to say, the only platform you could use is on Cork. Now go solve this problem. And I mentioned diversity. I mentioned healthcare. We have a legal startup. We have a real estate startup. And to us, we view Uncork as the only platform you need to basically build from. You don't need engineers. You don't need coding. You don't need, you know, if you've got an idea, imagine you could take it to market in production and it's fully scalable and secure and, you know, compliant that it works for everyone.
No, I mean, that's amazing. And then, I mean, for example, some of the student founders we're talking to right now, I mean, they're all building these like amazing applications, right? I could just imagine being empowered with Uncork to be able to just, you know, use even human language, right? Just going through, as you said, 10,000 hours of Java. So I can definitely speak from experience how crucial that is in order to build something and empower something. I mean, that's just really, really amazing, I would say.
That's awesome. I'd love to hear more about, like, so we should be able to enable your incubator to use Uncork. Like, that's what we have to work on here. It's like,
of course, to be the platform
for your incubator. So every one of your students is building in a production system that's ready to go.
And I want to kind of even stay on that topic a little because, you know, Nathaniel, you know, we're only sophomores. And so, you know, what he's doing is new. And as you and I'm sure when everyone really, you know, knows at a certain point in their life that, you know, when you start something new, you're signing up for a lot of things. And so, you know, to really be, you know, the market credibility, sometimes Yale isn't enough, especially within this cloth. You know, you'll get, you know, a bit of ridicule, you know, when you're starting something new, no matter if it's, you know, the perfect concept or idea. But how do you gauge if what you're doing is really, really impactful?
I love it. So, you know, I had a C-suite job that most people would say, like, that's their goals. And when I left to build on Cork, because I said, someone has to, and someone needs to do it that knows the problem, and no one seems to know it, but what I'm seeing. The interesting thing was we were told no by every Midas or top investor you could ever meet. We had 300 no's in 6 months. And every single investor said, you're too old. You know, you should have had one investor said, if you worked a year at Citigroup, there's no way you could be CEO. You're institutionalized. Another investor said, the idea is too difficult. It won't work. There's no. So, you know, we took every one of their quotes that was negative and we didn't say who said it, but we put it in a quote wall, which is outside my office here. And, you know, it's a 20-foot wall that you could see. And literally, like, we take pictures in front of it and it made Entrepreneur Magazine, which is pretty cool, the quote wall. But it's how do you turn the negative into inspiration so it drives us all? And that's – so you have to believe in yourself. You have to believe because I had to self-fund this credit card to credit card living on a couch. I gave my kids the bedroom while I was using a couch because I didn't have space and I couldn't afford anything bigger. And you have to believe enough in the idea and go all in. By the way, it's no different than if you're in a corporation. Like if you're in a corporation and you choose not to do an entrepreneur route, but you're going to work for a company, like you have to be able to believe in yourself enough to say, you'll find another job somewhere if something goes wrong. So push the limits, you know, let's push how hard we could go. I would say, you know, anyone listening that's going to work anywhere, my number one goal is always, could I eliminate my current job? Like, can I eliminate where I am right now? Can I automate my tasks? When I was 22, I built a code generation system so I didn't need to actually write code as an engineer. And then like every step along the way, all I kept doing and thinking was, how do I eliminate what I'm doing today so I get a bigger job tomorrow, which would be more fun? And could you imagine if every human being in the world today simply said, how could I do what I'm doing today better so I could do something bigger tomorrow? Like it would be a whole new world we live in, like from that perspective. And instead, there's too much fear. There's too much fear of change, fear, you know, denial that it's here. Like, and to me, it's just a huge opportunity if we could drive that mindset.
I mean, first, I definitely see that quote wall. That just definitely sounds amazing.
We could send you a picture. Wynn could send you a picture after this. We'll get that to you.
Yeah. But yeah, I think besides that, you know, you mentioned how there was a lot of no's, right? And just talking about Intel in general, right? Passing through, I guess, all the dissuasion and getting to the point where you know you can see a problem and maybe some other people can't see it, but that's, you know, the makings of an entrepreneur. So very curious to hear, you know, after all those no's, et cetera, how did it feel to finally someone to kind of validate that in the sense that, you know, you always miss a problem and you want to fix it, but someone was saying, we're going to invest, we're going to help you guys get there.
It's a great question. It wasn't an investor that validated it. So we said, you know what? We know what needs to be done. Let's get a client. Let's get two clients, three clients, four clients, five clients. So in 6 months since we started the company, we had five major named customers, like Liberty Mutual was our first PNC customer, and Principal Financial is our first life insurance customer. And these are names which are incredible names. And they worked with us. They believed in us. They believed in the vision of Codeless, which is what we've created. And this vision that, like, you could do something without code and with, and they're all customers today, which is amazing, still 6 years later. And what was interesting was we had revenue before funding. And once we had revenue, we proved product market fit. We said, we get it. It works. We kept, and I would say you never stop learning. So you continue to evolve. The product evolves, the investment. Every meeting I go meet a customer, it's an opportunity for me to learn more about what to do in the future from us, for the product, and like, you need that mindset. You need an open mindset. There are too many software packages that just are sold to you. They're pushed to you like drugs in many cases. It's like, we want to get you hooked and just keep buying it. And even if there's no value to it, we want you to basically get addicted to this and use this software, and they have no value and they leave you worse off. And so like, that was the, what was interesting was when I left the CIO world, so chief information officer world, many of the CIOs who I used to be peers with said, when you do this, Gary, like you're going to leave our world. Like, how do you not become evil? And like, they were referring to these large corporations, the mega corporations, who viewed each of them not as a valuable leader or asset, but as a pile of money that they're going to come tap. And like, that was kind of the view. So it was, so to me, it's being open and listening constantly to what's happening around you.
Yeah. Listening, I think is, I mean, as the viewers are now, just listening, just in its most broadest general sense, I think is one of the biggest key takeaways. Pieces of advice someone can give, especially, you know, young founders, young aspiring founders, just, you know, it's not all about the pre-seed round. It's not about, you know, raising those actual monetary funds. Sometimes it is just as simple as tuning in once a week, or reading a Business Insider article.
Constantly. So do you have something you do in the morning as a routine to get started? Like, what's your, you need a routine, right? Is there any morning routine or any nightly routine?
Yeah, I mean, I have one. I'm not sure if Nathaniel does, but
definitely do.
I'm an early morning guy. But tell me,
what's early? I got to ask. What's an early morning? Tell me.
Six for me. Early six.
Okay, that's early. I like that. If I could get my kids out of bed at six, that would be an amazing thing.
Yeah. I was there a few years ago, but I guess it's the age. I guess getting older.
Yeah, and so like to me, when I wake up, and it's a little before that, but like I'll do something consistent. I'll do a you know, a Sudoku puzzle or Ken, or I'll do a Wordle, or there's a new game, New York Times Connections, which is I do something to get my mind going. Like before I check emails, before I check work, before like with a cup of coffee, that's kind of my, it's good to have consistency in something you do to get going. And then at night I do the exact opposite. So at night, like I'll probably play a game of Candy Crush before bed just to kind of like zone out, because there's nothing there. That's like the most brainless thing you could possibly do.
Right.
And it's a way to shut down and go to bed, which you need.
Right. Shutting off and shutting on. One of the, I guess, biggest, because I mean, entrepreneurism is, you know, like we always hear it, it's a roller coaster, especially at like the startup level, right? So just shutting on and shutting off, it can be kind of hard. Like we feel that, yeah, I guess. Like, when am I going to stop studying? It's 1 a.m. and I know I have to get up at 7, like just shutting off and shutting on. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember those days. I do remember those days. And look, when you graduate college, and congrats and going to an amazing school and for building this podcast, like there was no podcast when I was going to school. I wish it'd be a whole new world if there were. But like it's, you know, just keep that same growth mindset in everything you do in life. Just keep that going, because you're a sponge and you should never stop. Like the only time you should ever stop is like that's when your heart stops and everything else stops at the same time. But keep your brain active and moving, for sure.
No, of course. I mean, that's kind of the motto, right? I think definitely as an entrepreneur too, it's always the mindset that, you know, you can obviously cool down, relax, but you know, you're never really not working, just because it's such a passion. It's such a thing that you're engrossed in that it doesn't even feel like work. It's just a thing that you do.
That's good. I like that. You know, every morning I wake up, I'm excited for work, and I know I'm going to be beat over the head 10 times by something I didn't expect. And it'll happen consistently. There'll be something that either like, you know, our competitors these days are $1 trillion companies. That's who we're competing with. So there, it's not easy. There's no, and so the tactics that are used in many cases are just take the software for free because they can afford to and we can't. That's the, and so, so when you look at that and just like, so to me, it's wake up every morning, love what you do, and just realize there's going to be 10 to 20 problems you didn't think when you woke up that morning are going to hit you. And look at those problems as something fun to solve, because like it's in your control as an entrepreneur.
Because your life would be hell if you look at it like it's the worst thing ever, right? Because it's going to happen. It's inevitable. So why not look at it in the positive light?
Yeah, absolutely. Like there's a Wall Street firm that's known, at least in the past, as like the more issues you point out that you've seen, the more you move up in the corporate world. So the higher you move, the more issues you point out. Not the solutions. The more, you know, you point out the problems, the higher you move up, which is exactly the opposite. It's like, no, you should be able to actually be promoted based on your successes of solving problems and make that the challenge. No one should be pointing out problems consistently in their day. That's not a fun thing to do.
Yeah. Right. And it's all about mindset at the end of the day. I think that that's, you know, people say I was an entrepreneur. I think that all goes back to the basis of how you respond to something. We respond as seeing it as a challenge, or responding as saying, how can I, you know, make this better?
That's exactly it, for sure.
Yeah. The people listening, including us, we kind of need to be reminded that, especially, you know, with the stakes being so high, you know, 2023, it's like you're kind of sold this perception that, you know, you're supposed to be rich when you're 17. And so I guess just keeping all this in perspective, you know, the often reminders are necessary.
You know, there's Barking Up the Wrong Tree is a great book. If you haven't read it, it's a book. There's another book, How Will You Measure Your Life, is another book. And all these books, they have the same concept, which is like, what are the metrics that are important to you that you judge success and happiness? And I love the stories. I love you set the metrics that, you know, are important, and that's how you're happy. And some people set metrics like you said, 17. If you're not a millionaire, what are you doing? Like that's the wrong metric. That's the like that at 17, I was still skateboarding. And if you saw me at 17, I'd be like, I'm not going to work at any company. I'm going to like be doing this the rest of my life, and I'm going to be on the beach surfing, and I'm going to be, and that was the, so I was definitely not, when I was in college, I went to college saying I was going to be I was a marketing major. So I was a advertising and marketing major in Stern School at NYU. And if you met me in my junior year, I would have said, I'm going to be pitching advertising and coming up with ads on TV and radio. And I loved it. And they forced me to take one computer science class. And like that one class in junior year that they forced me to take, I was coding since fifth grade. I was helping my dad, and everything came back to me, and suddenly it was like light bulb went off, and I finished a second major in computer science and MIS at the same time. So I did both. Wow. And I still, when I graduated, said, I want to do marketing. Like I want to do like, and the thing was, there was no jobs. There was no, so my path took me to computer science. My path took me down. And like you gotta like, you know, one of my best friends always says there's signals through the noise. Like, where are those, you got to look for the signals in life through the noise. Right. There's tons of noise around us. And just the signals for me were like, hey, you could do marketing and you're doing it. Like we're doing it right now. You and I are speaking and this is marketing. This is everyone's a salesperson. Everyone sells. Right. And that's another Daniel Pink book, which is good. And the reality is like, but what's your special skill? It's I could speak to machines. Mm-hmm. That's my superpower in many ways. So yeah. That's what I love to do. And yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, like in terms of, you know, always going back to what you used to do, you know, when you're a child, I think there's like this recurring message sometimes of, you know, you're going to find your way when you're getting older and discovering new things. But I personally think it's all about, you know, identity. And I can see even just through speaking to another fellow coder, like the, you know, sole ability to kind of, you know, you said talk to a machine and create something and innovate something out of that, you know, that's ultimately what, you know, when you're reminded of that, you know, led you to this whole path and uncork and such. So, as to how fulfilling is it, I would say, you know, before that, you said you're into marketing, you really sold on going in that path. But when coding came back, you all of a sudden felt this kind of, you're saying, rush of this excitement on how you could build. So does that still fulfill you today? And did it fulfill you up until today?
It does. What's your metrics change? So I would look back and say, from a company perspective, we invented a category called codeless, which has now employed tens of thousands of people that weren't working before in this category. And that's true. Like that's how many jobs have been and, you know, and amazing jobs and, you know, all over the world, by the way. So, you know, from Australia to India to US, everywhere, but we have customers that believe in our vision and where we're going. And that's amazing. That's rewarding. It's probably the most rewarding is when the customer says, I love the vision. I love where you're going. And that's what we hear from our customers, because even a lot of the prestigious research out there would say, this category doesn't exist. Like they would just say it doesn't, it's not there yet. It's not in the categories. We're inventing it. So we have to write what it is and we have to define it. But, to me, it's more about like also the impact. So COVID hit, right? So March 2020, I'm not sure where you were. I was, coming back on a flight from business in California. There was no one wearing masks in New York City. And and the commissioner in New York City called us up and it was a Friday and they said, COVID's coming hard to New York. How quickly could Uncork stand up the COVID contact tracing system for 20 million residents? You know, every aspect of it, tracking where you are, the heat maps, where you've been, like, and we as a team got together with New York City and we built the entire software over the weekend and it became the epicenter of New York City. And New York City was the hotspot.
Saved us.
Yeah. So that was, but like the cool thing was, and they came back and said, we can't get food to senior citizens. Wow. There's no shelters are closed. Can't get food to kids. Kids used to go to school to be fed. Like kids, a big part of New York City schools is feeding the children. And so they can't get food. The schools are closed. The senior centers are closed. So within 5 days, we created with them like the equivalent of Grubhub from scratch. We built an entire software to request food, deliver food. There was National Guard loading boxes into taxis. We helped employ 18,000 unemployed drivers that were home. That's 18,000 employees we created in the company. And we delivered 2 million food orders to senior citizens. So to me, that's rewarding. And then the coolest thing was they came to us and said, by the way, we then worked with Washington, D.C. and Chicago and Illinois and every other states. And the cool thing was they came to us and said, like, people can't get married. And you're like, wait, they can't get married? No, because the clerk's office is closed. And it's an old COBOL system of record. So how quickly could Uncork stand up a replacement for COBOL and enable people to get married at home using Teams or Zoom or with a clerk and a judge? And and it took us another 5 days. We launched the entire Cupid system for people to get married. And, you know, we watched 38,000 people get married on our software the first year. So, and again, you know, on a surface, you're like, that's kind of cool. Okay, they got married. But I had met a judge all the way out Eastern Long Island. I met a judge and she asked what I do. And I told her and I said, for example, like we built a system for marriage licenses from New York City. And she goes, you know, I've married couples on their deathbed that their last wish was to get married before they died in COVID in a hospital. And the only way I did it was through your software. If the software didn't exist, we couldn't marry them. So she goes, you should see the tears in their eyes and what she's like. And I go back to like, what's your impact on the world? Like, what's the, how are we leaving the world a little bit better than when we started? And my feeling is it's my kids are going to do that. I've got a 10-year-old son who's launching rockets. He'll tell you he's got a better space company than Elon Musk. He's got like, he's launching, building carbon fiber rockets in LBR and launching them and they fly. Yes. I've got a 17-year-old who patented his first idea and helped build a company that's going to change healthcare, which is really cool. And you know, an amazing daughter who's creative in arts, and a 1-year-old who, I guess we'll see what his goals are going to be in life. Yeah. You know, it's got a lot, long way to go.
Long way to go, indeed. Yeah, Gary, I think this was more than what we expected.
Yeah,
you know, I think. You know, especially with you being from Queens, I mean, we're from the exact same place. So, you know,
I love, to me, I'm on the subways constantly. I, you know, in New York, there's no other place I could see being right now. It's, you know, it'd be nice to see, you know, I like visiting places, but like, here's where it is. And it's great to meet you both. And congrats on this amazing podcast and what you're doing for your students, for Yale, for the university, and for others. Yeah, so this is great. You. And anything you need, let me know. But it's been great to talk to you.
That means a lot, Gary.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks. It was great. Okay, take care. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye.
Hey, y'all. Sean here with a quick sign-off. Thanks again for tuning into this episode. If you're a founder, entrepreneur, or world changer of any sort, be sure to check out some of our partners to accelerate your business ventures. Whether it's consultation with Adventist Law, bookkeeping and ideation with Mighty Startup, accounting or advisory with AKM Global, or even tax help with Heartbeat and Partners, YFS will continue to build and support a strong community of student founders and entrepreneurs. And with our partners, Speaker Network, continue to grow and accelerate your ventures. Peace.